Welcome to Tech Tuesday on All Sides with Anna Stever, a show where we share stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. From contacts to coconut trees to Brat Summer, social media seems to have found a new it girl in Vice President Kamala Harris. TikTok and other social media platforms exploded with pro-Harris videos after news broke that President Biden was out of the race and Harris was in. Here's a mashup of some of the songs created since Harris announced she's running.
You think you just fell out of a coconut tree? You exist in the context of all in which you live and what came before you.
I'm just living that life. Fun Dutch cult classic, but I still pop every time my track drops. You're jealous. I'm just living that life.
I love Venn diagrams.
I really do. I love Venn diagrams. It's just something about those three circles and the analysis about where there is the intersection, right? Yeah, I see people that you agree with me, right?
Well, what we really need is a feminine omenon. A what? A feminine omenon.
Drop the beat.
I'm a never Trump guy.
I'm a never Trump guy.
I'm a never Trump guy.
I never liked him.
And we were all doing a tour of the library here and talking about the significance of the passage of time, right? The significance of the passage of time. So when you think about it, there is great significance to the passage of time in terms of what we need to do to lay.
Social media virality can give a campaign momentum, but Harris hopes to turn all these new Gen Z followers into donors and voters this November. Joining us now to talk about it is Abigail Dukosnik. She's an associate professor at the Berkeley Center for New Media in the University of California, Berkeley. Welcome to All Sides, Professor.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So this is the second presidential election since TikTok was a major social media company in the United States. But I don't remember being flooded by videos supporting a single candidate on either side in 2020. As someone who studies media, what do you make of all of this in the last week?
I think the last week has shown that a new generation of voters, you know, let's keep in mind, most of Gen Z was not old enough to vote in 2020. So the newest generation of registered voters is taking to their preferred social media platform, which is TikTok, and expressing their political views. And the way that political views are manifested on TikTok is through comedy, is through music and dance videos. So it is a new political vocabulary for the nation, I think, and something that a lot of Democrats really welcome because Gen Z is showing their enthusiasm through this relatively new platform.
More than 85,000 Harris videos have been posted since President Biden dropped out. That is a unbelievable amount of content. And the vice president herself has amassed more than 3 million followers in less than a week and having only 4 or 5 videos. So all of this, though, I think the biggest question for Democrats, for the electorate in general, is does this translate into votes come November?
I believe it will. I do think that if you're implying that a lot of Americans sort of participate in political discourse online, but then don't show up at the polls, I think that probably is the number one risk of this Harris campaign's huge tidal wave of social media interest, is that it might lose steam in the next 100 or so days. People might be cool posting memes and comments, but not actually register to vote. So I do think the Harris campaign has to be very clear, and all of its advocates, all of Harris's proxies have to really get the vote out and really teach young people that it's not just enough to be on socials. You actually have to send in your ballot or show up at the polls on election day.
It reminds me a bit of the enthusiasm around President Barack Obama's candidacy in 2008 when young millennials were jazzed about getting to vote for him.
I was thinking, too, just yesterday, that Obama was our Facebook president. Facebook was at that time still feeling
fresh,
feeling new. And millennials felt like they could organize in an entirely innovative way using Facebook and using their social networks. And that has that momentum or that feeling of excitement around using socials to promote a candidate has moved pretty much to TikTok, although Facebook and X and Threads are also really active in this discussion. It does seem like every generation has their kind of social media platform that marks their ascension into adulthood. And so Facebook belongs to the millennials and TikTok belongs to Z.
Yeah, a 2023 Pew Research survey found that one third of adults under 30 regularly scroll TikTok for their news. And that was up 255% from just 4 years prior. And so I think the Harris campaign is trying to meet people where they are.
Absolutely. And let's keep in mind that TikTok was for Kamala Harris even before it was announced that she would be the next Democratic nominee. Kamala Harris is extremely memeable. She dances a lot. She has a lot of very remarkable facial expressions. She's very reactive and responsive. And she says a lot of pithy sayings just off the cuff. She's quotable. So TikTok was riding for Harris even before Biden's announcement about stepping down, and has only increased its commitment to her. That said, when I scroll TikTok this morning, it does seem like right-wing TikTok has got a foothold in this campaign now. So it took right-wing TikTok a little while to get their engine running at the same speed as Democrat TikTok, but I do see quite a bit of anti-Kamala content on that platform now.
Yeah, I think... You know, what's interesting is I've seen also a lot of conversation about how whoever, like, we should give the interns running the Kamala Harris social media campaign a raise. But it does feel, at least her social media presence, particularly the Kamala HQ social media presence, has really leaned into the memes created about her. We're going to talk about it in just a second, even mimicking the style of the album of Charlie XCX.
Absolutely. The Kamala Harris campaign changed their color of their banner on X to brat green, the same kind of lime slime green that Charlie XCX uses on the cover of her album, Brat. They changed that color to brat green almost instantly after Charlie XCX posted Kamala is brat. So people were definitely watching their feeds, paying attention to which celebrities were endorsing Kamala that day. And a lot of celebrities came out for her right away. But when Charlie XCX came out for Kamala Harris, the Harris campaign took it up immediately.
Yeah. And if you don't watch TikTok, you may have only caught snippets of these viral moments on the news or these conversations. And I have to say, it's been interesting is maybe the correct word, watching television outlets try to explain how a pop star is defining the word brat, because there's been a lot of conversation about why is brat a good thing?
Absolutely. And for your listeners, just to recap my take on brat, and I'm referencing Charlie XCX's own definition, but using my own words, brat isn't a bad thing. It isn't a bad word. It's actually a good word in this context. By brat or brat girl, Charlie XCX means a girl who shows up at a party, is a little loud, a little messy, makes some rude comments, points out some inappropriate things about what other people are wearing. But in that way, being a little messy, imperfect, not all on point entirely. The brat girl is brave and strong, stands in her own power, is very authentic, and draws people to her just by virtue of being willing to be honest. So there is a connotation in our culture of brat being somebody who's spoiled, somebody who complains a lot, entitled. But in the Charlie XCX context, brat means that you're willing to let your messy parts show and that you're willing to be true to yourself all the time, every time. And for that courage, you're rewarded. You own the summer, you own your space. And so that's why Charlie XCX equating Kamala Harris to brat is about an attitude, and a positive attitude, and a real attitude more than anything.
Yeah, the Kamala Harris HQ has also leaned into a little bit of trolling of vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance. There is a song out there mashing up all of his negative comments about former President Donald Trump. They've set it to a very catchy beat, and you see her campaign sharing that song and like poking fun at him in a way that I was like, you've just never really seen from a presidential campaign before.
I really think that turn away from the Michelle Obama's famous line, when they go low, we go high, which Michelle Obama said at the 2016 Democratic convention when Hillary Clinton was the nominee. I really think that turn away from we go high all the time, we stay above the fray, we never sink to the level of insult slinging. You know, Kamala Harris's campaign has gone well away from that and is really responding to Vance's insults very directly and throwing it right back in his face, which I have to say isn't hard. J.D. Vance is very prone to malapropisms and stepping in it, as we say. And so the Harris campaign is really just highlighting what he himself has said, but in a way that is clearly meant to be insulting, is clearly meant to be in the game of playing, you know, who can respond to the other's campaign as nimbly and as directly and as humorously as possible. And I don't think that's going low. I think that's just being smart about responding quickly on social media in a way that draws attention.
I think it maybe adds to that authenticity conversation of, if you are, no matter what your political persuasion, like one of the things people like about Trump is that they feel like he just says what everybody else is thinking. And I think the Harris campaign is leaning into that.
Absolutely. I think for too long, maybe Democrats or the Democratic Party was thinking that authenticity equals professionalism, in the sense that, you know, we have to be real, but in a very professional way. We have to be ourselves, but wearing suits all the time and being buttoned up all the time and using correct language all the time. And I think the Harris campaign is noticing from Trump's example that actually authenticity doesn't have to mean being stuffy, being proper, being official. Authenticity often reads a lot better and clearer in these more casual registers, in these more popular culture registers, and this more real talk kind of register. So that is what that Harris campaign is doing. And I'm glad, because they have finally learned some of the lessons from the successes of Trump's campaigns.
As somebody who studies media and messaging, I do want to ask about the shift in the Democratic narrative, because I consume a lot of media as part of my job. And I have noticed this shift in, you know, Democrats are still talking about Trump in the context of being a potential threat to democracy, right? They're having that conversation about things that he said that make them uncomfortable. But there has been this very consistent effort in the last week or so to portray Trump and Vance, and by proxy, the Republican Party, as weird. This is the specific word, weird. I'm hearing it consistently in messaging, and I find it fascinating because of its simplicity, right? It's not Trump is a threat to democracy. It's Trump is weird, and we don't want the weird guy in the White House.
Absolutely. I think that previous message that you were talking about from the Democrats, which was Trump is a threat to our democracy, Trump's going to take away our right to vote, women's rights over their own bodies, trans kids' rights to medical care, that all of those messages that foregrounded fear made people afraid. And fear, being afraid, gives the other person, the other party, power. So weirdly, all of that negative messaging around Trump sort of made him seem like this super being who was coming for all our rights and had all of this authority already, even though he was voted out of power years ago. So I think that this new messaging of weird is very effective for the Democrats. And that signal is being boosted, you know, all throughout the nation beyond, which is great, which means that it's taking the place of the earlier message and is really dominant and prominent in people's minds. And weird takes away the opposition's power. Weird reduces the Trump Vance campaign to, you know, consisting of these little men who are just kind of awkward and are the opposite of the brat girl, as opposed to really dominating the party with a lot of spirit and joie de vivre. You know, the weird guys kind of are cringy in the corner, and nobody will talk to them. And so that's what that campaign looks like now.
Yeah, and you can see the pushback from conservatives, especially in social media, that somehow, like I saw Ohio's own Vivek Ramaswamy say, like, this isn't a popularity contest for prom queen. This is like a race for the U.S. presidency. Like, weird is such a dumb thing to be saying about someone. But I think they're pushing back so hard because there's a recognition that, like, oh, this might stick.
Absolutely. And I mean, in terms of dumb things to say, Trump has said a lot of dumb things that have stuck, like calling Hillary Clinton and Kamala Harris nasty, calling them nasty women, which is, by the way, a really weird thing to say about anybody. But those signals got boosted too. And of course, Hillary's campaign tried to co-opt that phrase, nasty woman, and made a lot of merch around it. But I think that Kamala Harris's campaign just understands the language and discourse of social media a little bit better and is responding in ways that really land with a large percentage of the population, like just directly calling Donald Trump really weird. And I think that also speaks to a lot of the never Trumpers, you know, Republicans who just don't want Donald Trump, who maybe preferred Nikki Haley just as a saner and more appropriate candidate for the highest office. And so it's a weird is a good message for Republicans as well as for Democrats, because I think a lot of people in the Republican Party were like, this guy freaks me out. He is not a normal person.
Final question for you. Do you think, looking back on the 2024 election, we're going to call it the TikTok election?
I definitely think so. I am already calling that in my head. I think TikTok is going to win this election. I still think TikTok is a battleground. I don't think that the Harris campaign or her supporters should think that they've got it all locked up because of the first wave of enthusiasm for her on TikTok. I actually think that both campaigns are going to go to combat quite heavily on that platform. And we will see a lot of messaging and counter messaging on TikTok. So we should be watching that space. And I think the fighting will be fierce. So we will see who wins the TikTok battle. But the party that wins the TikTok battle, I think, will win the election.
That was Abigail Dukosnik, a professor at the Berkeley Center for New Media at the University of California, Berkeley. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Coming up, getting farmers to take the lead in climate change. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides, a show where we bring you stories about science, technology, and the future of our environment. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Our second topic today is farming, specifically how farming and renewable energy could complement each other rather than compete for the same spaces. The USDA has invested $10 million into this idea, partnering with Ohio State and Central State, along with two universities in Missouri. Ohio State University professor Douglas Jackson Smith is the project's lead author. He's also the Kellogg Chair of the Agroecosystem Management Program based in Worcester, Ohio, at the Ohio Agricultural Research and Development Center. Welcome to All Sides, Doug.
Great to be here.
Anyone who's ever attended a meeting in rural Ohio about using farmland for renewable energy knows how contentious those meetings can get and how quickly they can devolve into arguments about oil, gas, and the overall benefits of sustainability. Given all that tension in these communities, how do you begin to talk about climate smart agricultural practices?
Well, climate's a controversial topic, as you know, in the rural and agricultural communities, and it's become a polarizing symbol for some people. But farmers are at the forefront of experiencing changes in weather and climate. And a lot of our work my students are doing and so forth, is really diving into how farmers process that, how they respond to that, what are the things they can do to kind of adapt to the world that's changing around them. And our project is kind of tackling that in a new and different way that kind of flips on its head the process of technological innovation and finding solutions.
So a big goal with your project is to let farmers lead the way. Your plan calls for farmers to design the implementation of these new programs. How does that work?
Well, there's a lot of research. I'm a sociologist, I should say, which is an unusual thing sometimes in agriculture, although I remind people that humans are the center of anything agricultural. And I spent the early part of my career trying to work with scientists and technologists to figure out how to get farmers to do things that we thought they should do. Long story short, what I've learned from that is the reasons farmers struggle to adopt things we invent or think they should be doing to improve, say, the environmental footprint of agriculture is because those things aren't working really well to meet all the complex goals and needs farmers have on farms. You might sequester carbon or you might see reduced, nutrient runoff, but unless that translates into, say, an agronomic or an economic benefit. In the case of climate smart ag, we talk all the time about having practices that make farmers more resilient to extreme weather. And we really do have things on the shelf that we think can contribute to that. But the lived experience with the farmers I've worked with for the last couple of decades is a lot more variable. They don't always see those practices translating into the gains that we promise. So part of the problem is the practices aren't so simple, and integrating into working farms is complicated and difficult. You can short circuit a lot of that process by bringing farmers in at the front end. And the benefits are that you can start exploring how to develop climate smart ag practices that work well under working farm conditions. You have farmers gaining more ownership over the problems and the puzzles and the solutions. A lot of the dialogue right now, certainly around renewable energy, but also in the climate space, feels to be very top down to farmers. And giving them a chance to help diagnose the problems and come up with the solutions is just a new approach that we think offers an awful lot of potential.
It sounds like the quintessential, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make them drink.
Exactly.
So some of the stuff that you've talked about in terms of conservation is longer crop rotations, using manure instead of chemical heavy fertilizers, how to be more efficient with their water usage. These sound, theoretically like easy switches, but they're probably far more complicated in practice.
Absolutely. And I think those are things we have, decades and hundreds of journal articles showing that they have potential. Cover crops is probably the centerpiece of a lot of conversations. Weaving in some crop you can grow over the winter to keep roots in the ground. Diversifying or re-diversifying new crops into rotations that are dominated by corn and soybeans. And like you said, bringing manure back in like we used to do, in lieu of, to reduce dependence on fertilizer and bring in more kind of holistic soil management. We know that this works in the lab. We know that that works in controlled trials. What we find is that when you take it out into the world and try it on farms are so diverse in terms of their biophysical conditions, They're really different in terms of the complicated crop rotations or systems they're trying to implement. And it's that adaptive work, that implementation work, where I think an awful lot of energy needs to go. So this project would give us a chance to build out on-farm research networks around Ohio and Missouri, led by groups of farmers that are interested, but, you know, say skeptical about the performance of these practices, and give them a chance alongside our team. We can measure what's going on below the ground, what's going on above the ground, whether we're seeing kind of the intermediate effects that should translate into benefits to farmers are occurring. And that'll give us a chance to kind of advance this conversation past the loggerheads we feel like we're at right now.
Is one of the challenges here that you're essentially asking farmers to take risks with their livelihood, right? If you change the way you grow your crops, the way you rotate your crops, how, what kind of fertilizers you do or don't use, you're essentially asking them to take a calculated risk with the future of their own families.
Exactly. And to see it working on at scale, you know, on farms in your area, is one of the primary ways one can sort of address that skepticism and confront, you know, with all the warts and problems, the realities of how to make changes in a complex farming system into some new directions that farmers haven't been going over the last 100 years. And so that risk is always going to be there, but having more information and doing it with partnerships, we think is a way to kind of overcome that barrier to people's willingness to try.
One of the areas that you're exploring is how to design large-scale solar systems that are compatible with agricultural. And as I said at the beginning, you listen to local community debates over solar farms, and like you will hear forceful, tense, like pitting neighbor against neighbor arguments. So how do we make solar compatible with agriculture instead of competing with it for space?
All right, let me just clarify. This new project is not focused on solar, just so people, the listeners know. And so what we're going to do is actually let farmers in these research clusters identify the practices that they think have promise, but where they have big questions, and we can help facilitate answering those questions. So those will probably be more of these cover crops, diverse rotations. It's possible that along the way, one of our clusters is going to embrace or propose some of these alternative energy kind of projects to think about how to improve the performance of those. Separately, I'm also working on a lot of projects, and I have colleagues at the university that are seeking resources right now to really squarely head on this conflict between rural solar, utility scale solar, and agricultural production. And in my county up here in Wayne County, it's a hot topic. We are really worried about, the community is very worried about losing prime farmland. We have some of the best farmland in the nation to what would basically be a utility power production plant, when we think that there are possible ways to develop or design those that allow agriculture to continue. 99% of the time in Ohio and in the US, it's a substitution for agriculture. There may be some very minor things you can do in and around the design of those solar panels, but they're not designing them with agriculture as a primary goal. In Europe, in Australia, in other places, they're way ahead of us because they have the same problem with rural political tensions and opposition in finding more of a trade-off. So what's a solar system that's not the maximum energy production efficient solution, but that's good and can do quite a bit, but also allows for more agriculture to occur underneath? That might be more widely spaced, higher up from the ground, or designed in ways that provide even net benefits to production of certain kinds of agricultural crops. And it's my thought that, you know, my contention that if you could bring that as the conversation to rural Ohio, it might shift the ground from where we are today, which is, I think, a blanket opposition in principle, to are there ways we can simultaneously shift, you know, our energy footprint towards more renewable energy and retain or even enhance in some cases commercial and agricultural activity.
Eliminating the mutually exclusive choice that we have right now.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a pioneering frontier for solar production right now. The utility companies or the solar companies aren't at the forefront of pushing for this. But as they recognize the need to address what they call the sort of social opposition problem, I think they are even, their ears are wide open in terms of pathways that might allow more of a win-win or a mutually acceptable kind of pathway in that technology.
So this $10 million grant towards working with these different cohorts of farmers to figure out ways in which they can adopt more environmentally friendly ways of growing their crops and raising their animals. What is the timeline for this project? Like, how, what is going to be the goal at the end of it after we've spent this money and done this time? What do you hope to get from this?
Well, I think at the end, it's a 5-year project and we're just launching. And so we'll have our first field seasons next year. We're recruiting farmers and having conversations with them this summer and fall about what they want to do in their research clusters. And I should say, we also have a lot of activities that are occurring at the community scale or engaging national political and market conversations about providing more incentives and rewards to farmers who use these practices. But this year is kind of a build out the infrastructure. And kind of what our project is at the end of the day is infrastructure, is a network that we can build that will then carry forward. By being authentically farmer led, we had trouble convincing the funding agency to give us the money because we wouldn't promise exactly what farmers would choose to do. But I think they bought the argument, and I think it's a good argument, that only by starting on day one with farmers in a leadership capacity are you going to shift this discussion and get to some new places. And so we're building up. We had farmers who helped write this grant from Missouri and Ohio who were involved from day one shaping the structure of it. But now we're gathering as a group. It's a real thing, and planning out the next steps.
That has
at the end of the project, let me just say, you know, we think we can really move the needle on the conversations around the use of regenerative and climate smart ag practices and really see a market uptick in Missouri and Ohio just because of the kinds of information and the way in which we're generating information. But it's also a model, a national model that's rather transformative about how you go about doing this. You don't just fund researchers, invent something, hire some, you know, extension education program to sell it. Here we're saying at the very origin of innovation, we got to have people in the room who are the audience, the clients, the users. And that always in my career has led to very interesting and unexpected trajectories of how you do the science and what kinds of technologies come out the back end. And so I think we'll see it as a model for the country as well.
I have to say, as a social scientist, you must be really excited about getting this opportunity.
I am. And it's something I've advocated for decades. And it's taken a while for the USDA and science institutions to see value in this kind of innovative approach. This, we call it transdisciplinary, where we're really trying to do science in provocative and new ways. And it's a bit of a gamble. Like this, they have a comfort zone funding traditional science. It's not a substitute for doing some conventional science, but I think we need a lot more resources in projects like this that are trying to think about in complex innovation in science and technology in a field like agriculture, where to really make it stick and to make it work, you got to do it outside the traditional university boundaries.
What do you think has convinced USDA and the federal government to try this different approach?
Well, the selling point of the project is the reality that we have a huge adoption gap. We've spent billions of dollars, decades, developing and promoting conservation practices. And for something like cover crops that in Ohio alone have gotten hundreds of millions of dollars, adoption rates are below 10%. And so something's not working. And I think a big part of that is how we go about developing and refining that technological change trajectory. And the fact that we've done it in a linear conventional science extension model and doing it in a new way is probably going to change the game. And so that's, I think USDA recognizes the adoption gap. They're accountable to trying to solve these problems. And I think they became more and more open to a project that's outside the conventional lane like ours.
That was Ohio State University Professor Douglas Jackson Smith with Ohio State's Agricultural Research and Development Center in Wooster. Thanks for your time today.
Good to be here. Thanks for inviting me.
Coming up, the first hydrogen-powered train gets ready to leave the station. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7. NPR News.
Here at Shortwave Space Camp, we escape our everyday lives to explore the mysteries and quirks of the universe. We find weird, fun, interesting stories that explain how the cosmos is partying all around us. From stars to dwarf planets to black holes and beyond, we've got you. Listen now to the Shortwave podcast from NPR.
You're listening to Tech Tuesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Streaming services can get expensive, but there's a new deal that bundles Disney Plus, Hulu, and Max. Here to tell us more about how bundling can save us money is Russell Hawley, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Welcome back, Russell.
Thank you.
If only I could get my words out of my mouth in a coherent sentence this morning. So the company has announced that this was coming in May, but this bundle between Disney Plus, Hulu, and Max, it's $17 a month, which feels pretty low for a bundle of streaming services these days.
It's true, but it's also important to keep in mind that each one of the bundle options that are available here are the advertiser versions. You're not really getting the like unlimited Disney Plus, Hulu, or Max without ads in between, you know, the videos that you're watching and, you know, without interruptions for certain things. This is very much the ad-supported version. But that's because the data has borne out from these companies that folks are okay with paying a little less in exchange for some of those ads that will roll in a couple of different places. You know, there are certainly plenty of people who would prefer not to have those ads, which is why the other tiers exist. But for this specific bundle, it is aimed at the folks who just want to spend the least amount of money to gain access to these services.
How does this apply to existing customers? Like, if you have all three of these services separately, can you switch over to try and save money on this deal, or is it only for new enrollment?
So you can actually switch over to any, you know, of the bundles that are available. This is something that Disney Plus has done in the past when it first set up its bundle with Hulu, where if you wanted that option to set up, you had the ability to either move to exactly the level of service that you currently have and have Hulu added on if you were going to it through Disney Plus, or you could move entirely down to the ad-supported tier and have that available for both. This is actually something that confused quite a few people when they started noticing the integration between Hulu and Disney Plus ended in certain horror films being highlighted on the Disney Plus, you know, kind of recommendation page because folks were also signed up for Hulu. So you got to be careful if you're doing stuff like this to make sure that you're keeping those parent filters up and not letting your kids access everything that you access.
In a way, this almost feels like a recreation of cable, right? You're getting all these different services bundled together for a single price, a single bill.
Lots of folks are making the cable comparison, and the joke is absolutely warranted. There is certainly, you know, room for that conversation, especially for those of us who remember, you know, kind of the bundle of premium services when cable was kind of the dominant way to watch television. But what you're actually seeing here is kind of desperation when it comes to the streaming services. You know, this announcement and this availability comes right on the heels of Apple acknowledging that they have spent multiple billion dollars on, you know, different shows for its streaming service, only for it to post of an incredibly tepid growth for its you know, period. Apple has done a lot of including a year of Apple TV if you get a new iPhone or if you get a new iPad or something like that. And it's turning out that folks are not sticking around after that free period is over, unless they go and pick up a new piece of hardware and get a new, you know, year of service attached to that. So a lot of this consolidation is likely going to be what happens over the next year or two as these companies realize that folks are really only interested in paying for like one or two subscription services at a time.
The great irony is that, you know, 10, 20 years from now, we'll have a whole new version of digital cable.
I think that is entirely likely that there's going to be, you know, there was an attempt, you know, when Apple TV, the hardware, not the software, first started, and Google's, you know, Chromecast and Google TV platforms, when they first started, a big part of that push was creating this kind of central interface so that you didn't have to log into a specific app and go to a specific thing. You could just say, you know, I want to watch Game of Thrones, but you could do it from like the main menu and it would just take it to you automatically. That didn't really work super well when it first started because a lot of the streaming service companies wanted to have you kind of in their ecosystem and, you know, exposed to you know, their stuff. I bet that that starts changing here in the next little while and some of these hardware providers start to have a little more leverage in how that information is presented to the audience.
Let's move on to talk about trains. Later this year, the first zero-emission hydrogen train, known as FLIRT H2, is going to take off from Southern California. The trip won't be very long, just a couple of miles, but why is this first trip so important?
Yeah, so we've had, you know, there are a lot of folks who are unaware of this, but we actually have several routes across the United States right now, most of them on the West Coast going from, you know, kind of north to south for hydrogen vehicles. There are hydrogen stations scattered throughout California, Seattle, and places like that. And there are a handful, not a ton, of hydrogen stations that will refill those vehicles. I was actually part of a test a couple of years ago for the first, you know, kind of road trip up, you know, using just hydrogen power a couple of years ago across California. And so that area was already well set up for that infrastructure in order for a train to be able to do this. It is, you know, when you hear about a train traveling, you expect it to be able to go a little more than the 9.6 miles of track that's currently available for this particular train. But this is a first, you know, having something that is not entirely, you know, reliant on electricity, something that we know through rigorous testing is actually safe to use in these places. And yeah, this is very much a first that is likely going to have quite a few fast follows across the U.S.
Yeah, for all we talk about cars and car culture and how we commute, so much of our physical goods are still shipped along train routes. So in terms of carbon impact, in terms of the environment, trains have a huge impact on the amount of fossil fuels that we're using.
That's exactly right. And at the same time, there's a fair bit of research that suggests that some of the engines that are built around being powered by hydrogen are actually capable of hauling in greater capacities than some of the current, you know, traditional trains that we have. It's not, you know, there's not going to be a wholesale replacing of these, you know, classic and still very effective engines, especially in places where it is not, you know, financially feasible to do so. But yeah, this is absolutely a positive step forward for how we get so much of our goods, you know, to all of the different places in the U.S.
Yeah, and in terms of how far they can go, Swiss company Stadler Rail has set a world record. In March, there were no passengers, but the train traveled more than 1,700 miles without refueling. That earned it a spot in the Guinness Book of World Records. But, I mean, going 1,700 miles without needing to refuel, that's better than any, like, gas-powered engine.
That's exactly right. Now, it's important to keep in mind that that was, as you pointed out at the beginning, that was very much a test. There were no passengers. There was also no cargo. You know, so it was very much, you know, can we get from point A to point B and how far can we do it? But that is still, you know, comparable to what you would see with either a diesel or gasoline engine, a pretty significant jump in what's capable.
So let's move on to artificial intelligence, because apparently we can't let an hour go by without talking about some variation of AI. So there is an AI startup now called WeMove that is supposed to help us quite literally move houses. So why do we need artificial intelligence when it comes to packing up and changing locations?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the most complicated parts of moving a house from, you know, moving all the things in the house from one place to another isn't just, you know, taking the time and energy of getting everything into a box, but actually figuring out how many boxes or, you know, the appropriate way to distribute weight inside of moving vehicles. You know, some folks hire, you know, private companies that go and make all of those decisions for them, and they load them into, you know, great big boxes and put them in crates and then ship them to different places where they unpack them. But for most folks, it is, you know, kind of a measuring game where you try to figure out, you know, what's the best way to get all the boxes into a truck so you can get them from one place to another. And the promise that this company is making is that you can use your phone to take a whole bunch of pictures of the stuff that you currently have in your house, either already in boxes or not, and it will use its software to make recommendations, not just on how many boxes you would need in order to, you know, to fill everything, but the best way to load that stuff into, you know, whatever size, you know, moving vehicle you have, or third party companies that would come and package everything up for you. It'll actually provide that information to them so that they show up and already know, you know, where everything is and what way everything needs to be distributed. That's kind of the promise that this company is making right now.
Yeah, one of the things, like if you're going to get a moving quote from a physical company that's going to do it for you, one of the things I've always heard is you want somebody to actually come out and look at your stuff, because, you know, a 3-bedroom house or a 1-bedroom apartment can mean very different things in terms of like how much space, depending on, well, basically how tightly you've packed all your stuff into that space.
That's exactly right. And, you know, this is, you know, not as big a problem for some folks as others. Some folks have people in their lives who are just Tetris experts. And they can kind of look at a space and go, this is exactly how that stuff fits. And those people are incredible, and watching them work in real time when it comes to moving houses is really kind of fascinating. But if you are like me, and you just kind of go, why can't I just shove everything in this place and be done with it? Something like this could actually end up being really useful. And the, you know, kind of the underlying technology here is something that a lot of folks have been using for several years now. You know, it kind of gets that AI label, but really the idea of, you know, kind of scanning your space and understanding the physical dimensions of everything that is in your house and how different pieces of furniture work, this is kind of the reverse of the way that Wayfair and Amazon and several other companies have allowed you to shop. By, you know, kind of representing the couch in your home by holding up your phone and kind of seeing it, you know, projected on the wall and what that would look like. This is really just kind of the reverse of that, where it's taking a scan of a couch and understand the dimensions of that couch and then relaying that to whatever group you're working with to move the house is a lot of information that even someone standing physically right there might struggle to get without having to go and measure everything manually.
Speaking of couches, I want to close out this hour by talking about a little bit of misinformation that's been circling the internet. I know, you kind of set up that pivot, but...
That was not intentional, but yes, I did.
So there is this falsehood that's being circulated about vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance regarding his memoir, Hillbilly Elegy, and what did or didn't appear on those pages. And I want to be careful in how I phrase that, because I'm a proponent of not perpetuating misinformation. But the reason I wanted to talk about it is because I have seen videos like of pages reportedly of a first edition of Hillbilly Elegy that contains this falsehood regarding him and a sofa. And it's just fascinating to me how sophisticated we are getting, that we can produce pages that look like they came out of a book that someone is holding that claims to have text that it actually doesn't have.
That's exactly right. When you think about the many conversations that have been had over the last couple of years about how technology is being used as, you know, kind of disinformation or misinformation machines, at the same time that you have this unfortunate, you know, what is now basically a rumor about J.D. Vance, kind of propagating itself through the world, you also have tech giants like Elon Musk sharing videos of Kamala Harris's voice that was not actually her voice saying things. The way that this information gets spread so quickly is because at a glance, it's very convincing. You know, the origin of the J.D. Vance rumor wasn't just, hey, I heard this thing happened. It pointed to a specific page in the book with a level of confidence that would lead someone reading it to go, oh, I don't actually need to double check that, because, you know, how could someone be so detailed about this thing and have it not end up being true? But that's exactly what happened. You know, the confidence and being able to share with something that seems like authority is a big part of why some of this information ends up being as, you know, proliferated as it is.
Yeah, one of the things about it that made it perfect for misinformation was that there was this idea that you had to get the first edition, like the book that came out before 2016. And so if you had a later copy, then you didn't have the correct copy. So people could go and look at the book on their shelf and be like, oh, well, you know, that isn't a first edition. So how do I know whether this is true? And it also spawned, like, if you Google, unfortunately for Senator Vance, if you Google him and a couch now, like 36 articles from reputable, from like the New York Times, from USA Today, from the Associated Press, all these fact-checking articles appear as well, which continues and almost further perpetuates this conversation.
That's exactly right. And a lot of it comes from, you know, how much work does it require the person consuming the information to do to verify whether it's accurate? You know, if this is something, you know, a couple last week, I cannot imagine that this has only been a week.
I know.
But if you think back to when this started last week, you know, being able to list a specific page number and a specific, you know, version of the book, that pretty quickly becomes something that is difficult enough to verify that if it kind of already lines up with your political beliefs, then, you know, you're kind of going to just assume that it's true and move on. And in some cases, you know, it's easy to fall into that trap. It's easy to be guilty of that thing. And, you know, verifying that information is really one of the hardest things that is going to happen in the next couple of months. We're now less than 100 days from this election. And a lot more of this kind of thing is going to pop up regardless of ideology, and verifying that information before sharing it is going to be kind of the responsibility of everybody involved.
So the takeaway here is don't believe everything that you see on the internet. That was Russell Holly, Managing Editor for Commerce at CNET. Thank you, as always, for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.